Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We had done a podcast on cancer about a year and a half ago with Dr. David Scadden of Harvard University and his book, Cancerland. It turned out to be the most listened to podcast of the last year. In it, he wrote so eloquently about the effect of the disease on the people who suffer from it and those who treat them. It was beautiful, it was poignant, but it was very sad. So in wondering whether it was time to do another podcast on cancer, I approached it with some reluctance. What could we offer that might provide new insights into the issue and its impacts? Ravages, really. And yet the urgent need to think about our approach to it in a wholly different fashion than cut, poison, or burn, meaning surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. I came across the writings of Dr. Azra Raza and her book, The First Cell, and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. This book, like few others, made me think about our approach to treating cancer in a whole new light. Dr. Raza's empathy for her patients, brilliance brought to bear on the subject matter, and her profound disagreement with what the medical community continues to pursue, from research all the way through to treatment, begs for your attention and consideration. I doubt you have heard anyone in the field quite as disturbed about what she is seeing as Dr. Raza. We present her to you today on America Trends.
With me on the line is Dr. Azra Raza, and she's written a book called The First Cell and the Human Costs of Pursuing Cancer to the Last. And Dr. Raza, I'm going to call you that because you have earned such respect in your field. You are such a remarkable thinker. This book is so well executed, and the message that you wanted to get across is clear. And you start off the book talking about the devastating human portrait of your own husband, Harvey's struggle with cancer. Why was it important for you to do that, to set the tone or the mood for the book?
Thank you very much for having me on your podcast, Larry. I'm also a great admirer of yours and have listened to many of your podcasts, and I feel that it's such an important moment for me to be in this conversation with you. And as expected, you have asked one of the most important questions about why I chose to put my own story as a prologue. Larry, the reason to do that for me was that suddenly what I saw in my life was that the theater of all of my actions have fallen. I had been an oncologist for 20 years, and yet when my own husband was diagnosed with cancer, it became a very deeply personal issue for me, but also because I had to serve as his oncologist. So I wanted to set the tone of the book from the first sentence to show that it is a deeply personal story as well.
And you did that so successfully. And you admit so many things in this book about your own feelings, about you as a practitioner, as a physician, working with patients who really invest so much in capabilities that you're going to bring to them, hanging on your every word, because this disease is so serious and often fatal that they really do trust in you. And you say, because the disease I treat is generally fatal, soulless, seems contrived, personal, academic success egregious. I mean, you really spare very little in this book about what it is that you and other oncologists are doing and the great responsibility you have to your patients, and you often feeling like you're really not able to give them what it is that they hope for or expect.
Think of my perspective for a moment. I came to this country from Pakistan in 1977, freshly graduated from medical school with the idea that I'm going to come here and cure cancer, because this is the only country that can that is affluent enough, number one, to afford the kind of research that needs to be done, and number two, is as welcoming to foreigners on the basis of merit as nowhere else in the world. So I come here with the idea, and I start treating and studying patients with acute myeloid leukemia even before I started my residency. And in 1977, I started treating patients with AML, acute myeloid leukemia, with a combination of two drugs, which are popularly known as 7 and 3, because 7 days of one, 3 days of another. Today in 2020, Larry, I'm still treating patients with the same two drugs. So can you imagine the level of my despair when I have to have the same conversation with patients over the last 40 plus years, and the same side effects? As I just read a beautiful book called The Blood of the Lamb by Peter DeRice, who wrote this in 1961. Imagine that in 1961, Peter DeRice is saying that, so, death by leukemia, because his daughter was dying of leukemia 2 years old. So death by leukemia is now a local instead of an express. Same run, only a few more stops. But that's medicine, the art of prolonging disease. This is what Peter wrote in 1961. Do you know we are using the same drugs 2020? And this exactly summarizes my feelings, that what we have managed to do is we perfected the art of prolonging disease. And this is an embarrassment to me, and we need to do better for the future at least. So, just to give you some statistics, there will be 1.7 million new patients diagnosed with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
We are curing 68% of those cancers, but curing them with what? Slash, poison, burn, surgery, radiation, chemo, the same techniques, same strategies. The 38% or 32% we don't cure because they present with advanced disease. Their outcome is no different than their outcome would be 1930 or 1960. So basically, 1% decrease in deaths from cancer every year for the last 30 years. Remember, this is being, everyone is thumping themselves on the chest and proclaiming it from rooftops, that 30% decrease in mortality. But number one, that 30% decrease comes after 60 years of increasing mortality because of increase in smoking. It parallels that. The decline in mortality is because, not because we came up with some grand new treatment, but because we, number one, the anti-smoking campaign finally began to show some benefits, and number two, because we are diagnosing cancers earlier and earlier, and the same strategies of surgery, chemo, and radiation that work in early cancer don't work in advanced disease. So those are the two reasons. In other words, what have we done with quarter of $1 trillion that we have spent since 1971 in cancer research? What have we come up with for $250 billion?
What do your peers, your colleagues, think about this? Because many are getting grants. We've had more brick and mortar cancer treatment facilities that seem to have a certain permanence about them. That gives a certain confidence. I hear ads on television, come to our facility, great treatments abound. I mean, are we being misled as the public?
Larry, I wouldn't say that we are being deliberately misled. No, I don't want to give that impression. First, I have to say that I just don't know, I never met an oncologist in my life here in America for 40 plus years who didn't care for their patients. And number two, even institutions that are using this kind of hyperbolic language, yes, they are painting the rosier picture. They always take the positive anecdote. They're not lying, but they want to give confidence to the public, and to some extent it is justified, because if you can be detected early, then we can cure you, but cure you with those same strategies. So I would say that it is always a concentration on the positive anecdote rather than what is happening to the majority of patients who are diagnosed with advanced disease. And it's just kind of a smoke and mirror approach, which is not exactly lying, but sort of mollycoddling the public and presenting only the positive.
Right, but don't we expect more from scientists? I mean, we don't want somebody who's in the field of science. We get a lot of that smoke and mirrors from politicians, clearly. We don't expect that from our doctors. And yet you have to walk this fine line, because you really do know that there are these aberrations and people do survive even some of the most complex cancers. I mean, I'll tell you today, I was driving back from this volunteer activity that I do on Tuesday mornings, and I turned on Today Show radio on my satellite radio, and a gentleman was on talking about 40 chemo treatments that he had for colorectal cancer, a young man, and he was saying that evidently colorectal cancer is on the rise among young people, and yet he was talking about how wonderful it was that he had survived that. And I was thinking, based on having read your book, well, that's wonderful, and his wife is now pregnant, but I'm wondering how long he will survive with the intensity of the treatment and the complexities and the toxicities of what he's already been through.
Well, I hope the young man will survive a long time and will be cured, but there is a chance that the disease would come back. However, I hope it's a small chance. I'm sure he's in very good hands. The question I'm asking is, yes, this poor young man is going through 40 chemotherapies. That is heartbreaking, even to think about a young person going through one round of chemo. Yet, I think we should try to imagine a better future, at least.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point, that I'm denying that there are patients who are suffering from cancer now, and we have to use the best measures and try to keep developing therapies for them. But I'm saying, is this the only approach even going forward, that we keep making these small incremental advances, or can we imagine a radically different future? And this comes from someone like myself, who is not just treating cancer, who has been also a cancer researcher as well. And that's where one of my first problems begin, that the drug
And you make that so clear in your book. You know what I'd love to do? Because I think the prose in your book is it's so remarkable. The book is called The First Cell, Azra Raza. And let me just read. I haven't known any authors who mind hearing their words back, so I hope you're not one of those. but let me just read this so people understand what you're saying. And this will take me just a moment. Unfortunately, most common cancers have proved to be more complex, with many more biologic aberrations driving the malignant phenotype. The trafficking of cancer cells is more labyrinth, tangled, knotty, and impenetrably convoluted than the London Underground. The cell continually transforms itself, covering generations of its natural lifespan in mere hours, ditching genes and entire chromosomes, acquiring new mutations, revving organelles, deforming proteins, neutralizing death signals, forging ahead deliriously, driven by the unrelenting engine of malice, bursting its hot contents on unsuspecting organs, impregnating them with its potent malignant seed, callously moving on. Cancer rules over the host with despotic autocracy. Now, I want to get to this and ask for your comment. To develop treatment strategies for so dense a disease by attempting to duplicate its complexity in tissue culture cell lines or animal models has been an unmitigated disaster. Explain that.
Thank you so much. It sounds much better coming from you. Basically, the issue is every time a cancer cell divides into two, there are potentially two new cancers, because as the DNA is being copied very rapidly, now abnormally rapidly, because everything is accelerated in a cancer cell compared to a normal one, then it makes more mistakes in copying the DNA, and so the new mutations give rise to potentially new biologic characteristics in a cell. So let's say we even take cancer cells out today, take it to my lab, I study the cells, I find the perfect drug for them. I come back to give it to the patient 6 weeks later, I give the drugs, they don't work in the patient. Why? Because the cancers moved on in the past 6 weeks in the body. Each time the cancer cells divided, they formed new cells with new potentialities for malignancy and for metabolic resistance. So what I am saying is, using reductionist approaches, like sort of give the idea that there's one gene that is the master gene that's controlling all the functions, and once we find that one gene, we can find the one abnormal protein or signaling pathway, and then we can target it with one magic bullet. This was a good idea, and it worked in a couple of cancers, which made us try to find the same one gene in every cancer that's gone abnormal, but that turned out not to be the case, and it turns out there are multiple genes, thousands in fact, that could be mutated or abnormally functioning. So this is the problem of having a very complex disease and trying to harness it into a sort of linear, simplistic narrative, which is a reductionist approach that scientists have taken.
With about 200 types of cancer, and you reminding us that to say cancer is one thing, or to put some kind of uber terminology to it, really is like saying Africa, when you've got all these different cultures and countries. I mean, it just is, as you say, so simplistic. And I think if anybody can come away with one concept, it might be the immortality of a cancer cell as you describe it.
Yes, exactly. And that is why when we develop drugs using these simplistic reductionist measures, very sophisticated technology, but the idea of reductionism, studying one thing out of a tsunami of abnormalities and bringing it to the bedside to benefit the patient, I call it an unmitigated disaster, because 95% of those drugs brought this way fail today. And the 5% that succeed should have failed, because they end up benefiting a fraction of the patients treated, let's say 20 to 30%, for improving their survival by a couple of months, and then causing not just physical toxicity to 100 people for the benefit of a few months to 20 of them, we also cause financial toxicity. 42% people in this country who are now diagnosed with cancer will become financially completely ruined by two plus years of their diagnosis. This is unconscionable.
And the failures, as you say, very succinctly, are systemic. So the entire industry that we have, and I'm only calling it an industry because there's a lot of money involved, there are many incredible people, as you say, working in it, but it really has taken on something of a life of its own. How do you begin to turn around the approaches that have been taken for the grants that have been awarded, for all of the work that has gone in labs for the last 15, 20, 30 years, looking at the same approaches, using mice, things that you tell us really will not change the trajectory of what it is that we're seeing in any dramatic fashion?
Larry, I think it's very clear to you and me, people who have been experiencing the practicality of living, that nobody ever gives up what they're doing willingly. And I don't expect anybody to suddenly get converted to my idea. If I think my idea is a good one, then I have to prove it. I have to show the success, and then everyone will come around. And the simple analogy I would use is, if we kept tinkering with the typewriter, we would never have the word processor. Now, who remembers a typewriter even, since the word processor came along? The same way we have to make this quantum leap. So I told you that I came to this country in 1977. By 1984, as early as 84, Larry, it was clear to me that in my lifetime, this acute leukemia will not be cured because it is so complex. And so I started paying attention to my patients' histories, and many of them gave a history of low blood counts for months or even years before it evolved to cancer. That phase is called pre-leukemia, before it develops acute leukemia. Those pre-leukemic diseases came to be known as myelodysplastic syndromes, MDS, which is what I head the center for at Columbia University. So back in 1984, Larry, I realized that the best way to deal with this ferocious end-staged advanced leukemia is to try and catch it early and intercept before it becomes the end-stage monstrosity, which is uncontrollable. So I started studying patients with pre-leukemia, and because I was a fresh arrival from Pakistan, not so fresh by 1984, but I hadn't gone to school in this country, which meant if I had gone to school here, I would have then moved on to try and make an animal model of the disease. But because I didn't have that background, I kind of depended upon my intuition and said, well, if I'm going to study this disease, I need to save samples on my patients. And I just started banking bone marrow and blood samples on my patients from that day on.
And you have the oldest tissue repository in the nation, or is it in the world?
Yes, in the world, 60,000 samples from thousands of patients. And do you know, Larry, I'm proud of to say that not a single cell has come from another oncologist. I have personally taken care of every patient. And this is especially poignant to me then, because it means every little vial in that tissue repository means something sacred to me. Because I have subjected these patients to undergo painful procedures. And how noble they are to say, Dr. Azza, even if it doesn't help me, it might help someone else. Just go ahead and take my sample. And so I have developed this tissue repository. And over the years, I keep going in and studying a few hundred samples at a time. And every time we end up with papers in high-profile journals. But is that what I really need, another paper in Nature or New England Journal of Medicine? No. What we need now, we were waiting for technology to develop, and we were working all along with new technology as they were coming, becoming mature. But now we do have all this latest sophisticated techniques of proteomics, genomics, metabolomics, transcriptomics available. In addition to the latest imaging scanning devices, I say that we use all of those things. Plus, we have all this tissue now on my patients who are studied serially as they traverse this journey from pre-leukemia to a worsening stage of pre-leukemia or to acute leukemia. If we can start studying all these samples from humans taken through in a longitudinal manner, then we may be able to trace it back to the earlier steps and say, ask the question, what made some normal healthy individual even be susceptible to develop pre-leukemia? What were the risk factors? What genomic or proteomic markers can be used to monitor healthy individuals to see who is at high risk for developing this disease? And then try to monitor those people in a concentrated, focused manner to diagnose it as early as possible and nip it in the bud.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Thus, the first sell, the name of the book, and not chasing after these end-stage treatments that are so difficult and oftentimes not successful. You say we need instead to commit to anticipating, fighting, and destroying the first cancer cells. We must reliably detect faint footprints of cancer at the beginning and stop it in its tracks. Now, you do tell us that there is great work going on in that area. You talk about things like smart bras, smart toilets. I mean, tell us where you think the greatest hope lies in some of these efforts and whether, in fact, what you're saying, and I'm sure others in your field sense the same thing and maybe are not as articulate or as engaged in making certain that the public understands this, but tell us where that movement is going and whether you think we're starting to make some change in the way that we're looking at cancer.
A couple of things. One, I'll make a big pronouncement right now for the sake of your audience, which is that I think that the decade of 2020 to 2030 will be a decade of complete overhaul of the healthcare system, with attention being paid more to prevention in every chronic disease rather than treatment. And cancer will be leading the way because, and this is what I wanted to say, the next thing is the reaction of my colleagues to the book. I was expecting to be put in the doghouse because I have been so uncompromising in my criticism, as you pointed out. But then I have to tell you this story. It's really a joke, but it applies to me. These two guys are walking in the garden, and one of them takes out a cigarette and starts smoking. So the other one is shocked, and he goes, "Oh, you smoke?" He said, "Yes." "How many cigarettes?" He goes, "30 a day." He says, "Really? You smoke 30 cigarettes a day for how many years?" He goes, "30 years." So shocked, he says, "Wow. Have you ever thought that if instead of smoking you had saved up all that money, you would have a Ferrari today?" So the other guy says, "Oh, you're right, I could have had a Ferrari." Then he asks his friend, "Well, do you smoke?" He said, "No, of course not. So where's your Ferrari?"
Well, by the way, you have another joke that you say goes around in medical circles that really does punctuate the points that you've been making. Why should you never give an oncologist a screwdriver? And the answer, because they will open the coffin and carry on treating the patient.
That's not a joke I tell, by the way, but yes, that is something that oncologists tell all the time. I think, unfortunately, that's a criticism directed at us, and you're right. It's exactly what I direct myself and all my colleagues. So the question I asked is, where's my Ferrari? If I'm saying that since 1984 I have been dedicated to this early detection campaign, what do I have to show for it? Well, at least you know that I've been consistent, that I did concentrate not on just acute leukemia but on pre-leukemia. I've saved all the samples. It took me some time. But I'm so excited that now what's happening is that everyone is realizing, and instead of negative comments to my book, most people are saying she's right, and at least she's right about the accurate identification of the problem that we haven't succeeded. Whether everyone agrees with my first approach or not, that remains to be seen, but at least everyone agrees that I've identified the main issues properly. But then where do we go from here? What is in the future? The future, I think, is already here because there has been a lot of concentration in the last few years to use the technology to diagnose cancer early, and I give you a couple of examples. Toshiba is a company that in Japan that announced last month that they can use one drop of blood in 4 hours. You, for the cost of $180, they can detect one of 12 common cancers from the blood, liquid biopsy, one drop of blood. Imagine this. They already announced this. You can look it up through Sheba Early Detection. Then the company Grail, for example, in America, also showed that using their special technique for identifying cell-free DNA and cell-free nucleic acids from the blood, they can detect 13 cancers from solid tumors like pancreatic cancer, etc., from the blood because of the mutated DNA that is circulating. So let's say they find some circulating cell-free DNA that's mutated. The next question is you want to know where it's coming from. And they've developed a methylation signature that can, with 93% accuracy or now 97% accuracy, tell you the organ from which that DNA came so that you can concentrate on, immediately focus on, oh, something going on in the pancreas. And then you are aware that something is going on, you can initiate treatment early. And we know that early treatment works even with these primitive paleolithic techniques. Even they produce some good effect and curative results in early detection. But more important, we have learned that cancer sheds its markers in all kinds of secretions, blood and sweat and tears and urine and stool and saliva and breath. Every compartment can now be harnessed to for the early markers of cancer, and devices are being built now. You mentioned the smart bra. That smart bra is a bra that is fitted with tactile sensors that can detect changes in temperature and pressure. And women have to wear the smart bra 2 hours a week. That's it. And then if there is any change that suggests the presence of a malignant collection of cells which are attracting a lot of blood supply to themselves, then that area is hot and will be picked up by the smart bra. This is so different than doing a mammogram, which is very painful and can miss a lot of tumors once a year. So you are now going to change from studying annually for screening measures to continuously monitoring the human body literally as if it's a machine for any breakdown before they become clinically apparent. You are looking at perturbations that are caused in earlier stages and trying to take action. The same way we can have devices like you go to sleep in bed sheets that overnight just scan you constantly for the presence of abnormalities in any organ. You can sit on a Fit Loo, which takes part of your urine and looks for presence of, say, colon cancer or pancreatic cancer. These are all things in the next 10 years that will be coming one by one or simultaneously, but people are realizing that that is a much better way. And I think that if we identify this new goal of early detection and we financially incentivize it, then those very sponsors who are investing billions of dollars in enterprises that have a 95% failure rate, like drug development right now, would love to go for something early like this. So I think if the whole field can turn around in a paradigm shift, as long as we show some success, and that's incumbent upon us to show in the next 10 years by studying human samples, studying the tissue repository like I have, other people have, on solid tumors, whatever they have to do, they have to find the earliest markers and then fit devices and scans and images to start giving us the results.
Is that where the torque is going forward as it relates to research? And I would imagine that what you've done with human tissue and with your pronouncements in a book like this, that you are getting the attention of people in your field who say there is a better way, she's right. And I would ask you, is the government or these funding sources that you talk about, are they beginning to say, look, we've gone down this path for so many years, we need to go down this path? And do you see that torque moving in that direction?
Well, the government, first of all, is made up of individuals also. So the same people are directing everything. And I have to say they've realized all along that prevention, early detection, monitoring, and screening for cancer is the only thing that has really helped decrease the mortality. But early detection measures such as they're so ancient and archaic already, mammograms, and imagine putting a tube in somebody's colon to look around and find a cancer. I mean, how primitive is that in this day and age of smartphones, etc.? So I'm saying that the government is very much aware and they have been investing, but not enough. And I'm making a plea that they should invest at least 50% resources into the future. And the future lies in developing the new technology or taking advantage of the new technology to have a better vision of what we can do for our patients. I really want to get away from this chemo and radiation. These are things that mutilate people. These are things that really make people sick. Children we are curing, but they have so many developmental issues later on, many of them. Many can become infertile from it. We need a better future. And for that, I'm very optimistic, I'm very hopeful, and I think the government will turn around very quickly as soon as results start coming out to show that this is a better way.
Well, your intellect and compassion are on such display in this book, and frustration. Let me ask you, as somebody who deals with leukemic cancers, I mean, how exciting is it for you to know that a lot of the mysteries surrounding all of these cancers can be found, discovered, and perhaps treated early on because of that transport mechanism of the blood? I mean, for you, as someone who's worked in this particular field of care, dealing with cancer, how, well, exciting in a sense is that for you?
I have to admit to you that I am practical enough to know that most of the things will not that we detect and find as early footprints of cancer will not be able to explain the complexity of cancer. In fact, the chemotherapy that we have been using for 50, 60 years already, for most of them, we have no idea how the chemotherapy works. We think it works one way, but when we give it to patients, it's not working that way. I challenge anybody to tell me how the two drugs, 7 and 3, work in patients. As I have been using it for them for 43 years. We don't know exactly what they are doing in the body at all. So I don't think we will have a neat explanation and understand the complexity, but I think we'll have at least we'll be able to control it because we catch it early enough and learn ways to just get rid of it. So I think that that to me is very exciting by itself because it means that we will be saving patients, not just curing them, but also saving them from disfiguring and terrible treatments. And I'm sorry that I had to literally wield a lot of poetic harmony to just depict the entropy of cancer.
When we read about breakthroughs, and you know in the popular media, we glam on to any news release that may come out. You say to us that when you look at animal research, particularly with mice, that we're really looking at the equivalent of gossip and not something that people should, you know, hold all kinds of hope out for. We know that people are going to other countries looking for alternative cures. I mean, there's a certain level of desperation that occurs when you get the sentence in many ways that you now have to deal with cancer going forward. What do you say to people who still read the popular press and believe or want to believe that this is a great breakthrough that they're reading about?
First, I ask myself the question always, Larry, what would I do if I was in this situation? Let's say today, if I am diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, I have been treating this disease for 43 years. I have been criticizing the way I have been treating it. If I get it, what would I do? I would take the treatment. I would give myself that small chance also, because this, what do I have to lose? This is all I have right now. So to the patients, my answer is always, you need to find and trust the best oncologists. And all said and done, America is an amazing country with a fantastic healthcare system. What we are, the doctors here are able to accomplish is nothing less than miraculous in so many places. And the oncologists really know whatever they have available, how to use it to the best advantage of the patient. So while we don't have to listen to propaganda which may be misleading or hyperbolic over statements, we certainly should trust our oncologists to be guiding us properly and telling us, and also telling us when enough is enough. When a stage comes that everybody realizes that further treatment would, and this is something I constantly am battling within my own mind, first do no harm. What does that really mean? Because everything we give, there is a certain harm associated with it, including aspirin. There can be just bleeding, somebody can bleed to death from taking aspirin and opening up an ulcer that's already there. So there are always potential risks involved with everything we give. But on the other hand, we have to weigh what the benefits are given the risks of what we are suggesting. First, do no harm, on the other hand, is something very odd, because this particularly applies to cancer, where what we are saying is that, look, in any given situation, instead of taking an active, proactive step, if not doing anything is going to benefit the patient more, then what should I do? So when you ask me about how do we advise patients not to listen to misleading advertisements or propaganda, I think that what I'm saying is there, you should listen to the oncologist and you should be giving yourself the best chance that medicine has to offer today, but also be prepared to know when because all the battle is going to be on the body, for the body, by the body, and by giving so many toxic treatments, a point comes where we don't know whether we are shielding the organs, trying to shield the organs from the cancer or from the treatment we are giving, which is more dangerous. And that's the kind of situation where patients need the experience and observations and knowledge of their physicians. And we must not fail our patients there.
Well, I got to say that if this book was not titled The First Cell, I think an apt title would be Enough. Enough trying the approaches in the lab that we've been trying, enough, you know, at times in terms of the treatment protocols, when you know that it is only depleting the little time that a person has left in terms of being quality time. Let me just read your words one more time as we close this interview. You say, cancer research has been promising hope and delivering disappointments for a half century. Instead of letting cancer grow into an end-stage monstrosity, let us assemble our resources to preempt that battle and strike instead at cancer's root, the first cells. So I just want to leave people with your overarching and your really profound way of expressing what it is that we need to do and the reversals that we now need to make. Dr. Azra Raza, I can't thank you enough for being part of America Trends.
Thank you, Larry. It's been an honor. And to oncologists, I leave with Emily Dickinson's message, if you don't mind.
Of course.
Which is, I had no time to hate because the grave would hinder me. And life was not so ample I could finish enmity. Nor had I time to love. But since some industry must be, the little toil of love, I thought, was large enough for me. And until we find the cure, and until my last breath, that's what I want to do. And my toil of love is to look after my patients and offer them the best service I can. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you so much.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofit.